From WXXI News, this is Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, new data is providing a snapshot for us of 10 years of pedestrian fatalities across this country. 47,000 people died between 2003 and 2012, and another 670,000 were injured. So how safe is Rochester for pedestrians? According to one index, it's the ninth safest city in the state, but also accounted for the third highest number of fatalities for New York State over the same time period. So we're going to try to balance all of this out and figure out just how safe we are, how safe we should feel. Children, older adults, people of color are disproportionately represented, by the way. We'd like to hear your experience of being a pedestrian, whether you're on city streets, elsewhere, interacting with, say, bicyclists, motorists, etc. How about your experience as a bicyclist? We're going to look at initiatives underway to improve the sometimes difficult relationship among pedestrians, bicyclists, motorists. And the report called Dangerous by Design offers some examples of cities that have made streets safer for all of us. And we've got a helpful panel that will wade us through all of these issues this hour. We've got Eric Frisch here. He's a transportation specialist with the City of Rochester. Eric, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
On the phone with us is Stephanie Seskin from the National Complete Streets Coalition. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
David Vega Barakowicz is the director of the Designing Cities Initiative at NACTO. And NACTO, Eric is going to tell us what NACTO stands for. Eric, it is what?
National Association of City Transportation Officials.
He had it in front of him. That's easier. David, thanks for taking the time to join us as well.
Thanks for the invitation.
Well, let's start with this. And Stephanie, I want to start with you, with the National Complete Streets Coalition. 47,000 fatalities, to me, seems like a very high number. And Eric and I were talking before we came on the air, and, you know, one is too many, but 47,000 seems like a very, very high number. Am I wrong?
You are not wrong. That is an extremely high number of people who are dying just because they're out walking.
And give me a sense for where and why. The assumption I think a lot of us would have is that city streets are the deadliest places. How does that line up with reality?
Well, the fatalities are happening everywhere. I think a lot of them are in a more suburban-style neighborhoods where the streets were built for cars only, and you know, that was the goal at the time, but now as more and more people want to get out and walk, they're finding that they don't have the facilities and they're suffering because of it.
Erica has made the point, and I'd like to ask Eric that's kind of that same question, that for the folks who assume that cities are always going to be more dangerous for pedestrians, interestingly enough, there are times and moments and places in this country where cities are safer than some rural areas.
Yeah, well, I think that cities are more designed for pedestrians. In the suburbs, sidewalks are often hit or miss. Roads are designed for higher speeds. And certainly the faster cars are going, the more likely that you can be seriously injured or killed if you are involved in an accident as a pedestrian.
And there's also that factor of whether or not drivers are accustomed to foot traffic, right?
Sure. In the city, you know, we're a mixed-use, relatively densely developed community, and so people are used to encountering pedestrians on their drives. In the suburbs, you know, other than maybe the villages and some of the hamlets, pedestrians are often nowhere to be found.
Stephanie, is it simple enough that the single most determining factor for pedestrian fatalities, is speed?
Well, I'm not sure if it's I think speed is definitely a major factor. It's a major factor in all traffic crashes, regardless of if it's people walking or if it's people who are driving. And the way we design our streets to encourage speed is definitely a big influence on pedestrian fatalities.
And we're looking at some of the numbers from the Complete Streets, the National Complete Streets Coalition. And what it seems to me to be, among not only the fatalities from but among the 676,000 pedestrians injured in the last essentially 10-year period on streets across the country, it seems to be that children and the elderly are disproportionately affected. But I'd like you to walk us through some of that, Stephanie, how it breaks down in terms of what kind of pedestrians are more likely to be impacted, where, what we've learned from some of that. So let's start with who is more likely to be impacted.
Well, you hit on it. Really, older adults are disproportionately represented in pedestrian fatalities. They're just about 13% currently of the overall population, and yet they represent 20% of all fatalities. And that's especially alarming because the number of adults who are going to be 65 and older is going to double in the next 30 years.
Yeah.
And so that's really important. And then if you look at people of color and those communities, they're also disproportionately represented. You're seeing folks like who represent maybe 13% of the population and 17% of all traffic fatalities. It's a big issue.
We've got, okay, so you've got people of color, you've got the non-white population disproportionately affected, you've got children, you've got the elderly, and again, the population, and not just elderly, but essentially over 65, and I'm always very careful to demarcate there. But we've got numbers. Eric, I want to know how a transportation specialist looks at numbers like this. It's one thing to say, okay, kids are more likely to be injured or killed in a traffic accident, an older person more likely to be injured or killed in a traffic accident. But what do you start to do with that as a transportation specialist?
Well, I guess a good example here in Rochester is we do have a neighborhood traffic calming program that we've had for the better part, I believe, of 15 years now. And we have over 30 of our residential streets that are outfitted with speed humps. And that is a number one thing I get calls on, especially this time of year.
It really is, huh?
As it warms up. Sure. I'll probably hear from 75 residential streets in the city this year. And we probably, we have a pretty strict criteria for approving them, but we approve 1 to 2 streets every year for speed humps.
They all want them? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Everyone thinks that people are traveling too fast on their street. That's for sure. And the studies show there are certainly some streets that stand out as higher than usual.
I can relate to that. I have a young child now. I live on a street where there's a camp at the end of the street, a summer camp, and there's always parents kind of coming in and out to pick up. And the amount of times I've seen other parents outside of my own household, I've seen other parents standing in the streets with arms out asking cars to slow down. I think we all feel like that. But are you implying that it doesn't always match up to reality, that the traffic isn't always as fast as it seems?
Depends on how you define fast. I think, you know, if you're standing on the sidewalk on your residential street and somebody goes by at 30 miles an hour, it feels like they're going too fast. And you know what? I think they are. That being said, 30 is the city speed limit right now. There are a number of neighborhood groups that are interested in changing that, and I know that there's a movement statewide towards allowing cities and other municipalities to go down to 25 or even 20 city speed limits. And then if we combine that with enforcement, we might be able to get pretty good compliance with that and result in some improvements. We've certainly had tragedies on some of our city streets over the years. And, you know, we're trying to respond to that.
Why only 1 or 2 speed humps per year as a general guideline? For all the people out there saying it'd be perfect for my street, how come only 1 or 2?
Well, we try and draw the line at those streets that stand out the most based on the number of cars on the street and the speeding that we're seeing on there. And that's really to respond to the need to maintain quality response times for fire and emergency vehicles. We don't want to see speed humps necessarily on every street. We want people to drive safely. So where we know we have the critical issues, that's where we're seeking out speed humps and other sort of traffic calming techniques. And that's where enforcement can really play a role.
Eric Frisch is a transportation specialist with the City of Rochester. We're also talking to Stephanie Seskin from the National Complete Streets Coalition. And coming up, we're going to have a chance to talk to David Vega Barakowicz, who is the director of the Designing Cities Initiative at NACTO, as we begin to broaden the conversation about what cities want and how, you know, every city is a little bit different, but how do we approach urban design, transportation design, et cetera. So Stephanie, now, what to you was the most surprising part of your report, looking at a 10-year period? For me, it was the fatality number. And I actually don't know offhand if that fatality number has gone up or down markedly from previous decades. But what stood out to you?
Well, certainly just looking at those raw numbers and realizing that those aren't just numbers. Those are people. Those are family members and friends and neighbors. It's shocking. I've been working in this for a long time, and similar reports have been coming out for over a decade now. And it's, I think the more surprising thing maybe is that more needs to be done, and we're not quite there yet. Lots of cities are making efforts and certainly doing good work, but many more need to step up.
Of those 47,000 fatalities that the Smart Growth America compiled that incident data from 2003 to 2012, of those 47,000 fatalities, 4,394 children age 15 and under. And that is a very, very stark number. So you talk about things cities can do. We're going to ask Eric his thoughts on that in just a second. I'm always curious to get the local take. But Stephanie, what are some of the first things that you would want to see cities, municipalities do in response to some of these numbers?
I think adopting a strong Complete Streets policy, as the City of Rochester has done, and following that up with an implementation is really important. And that means that whenever we do transportation projects, we're thinking about the needs of everyone who's going to be on the streets. So people who are driving, walking, riding the bike, taking the bus. I think that's really key. And then recognizing within that our city streets need to be treated differently than our highways. Most of the time when we've built these streets in the past, we've thought of them along the same terms as we thought about major highways. And so treating them separately and creating our design guidance around that understanding is so important.
We always do like to have the context of where Rochester ranks. Is there any way for us to feel how Rochester does rank when we compare to either other cities in the state or around the country?
No one is great yet. We're not seeing places with just zero fatalities, but certainly within the state, Rochester is slightly better, you might say, than some of the other places, Binghamton, Albany. They have a higher percentage of traffic deaths that are pedestrians. But, you know, not as great as some of the other places in the country, and certainly more can be done.
Is there an example, Stephanie, of an American city that you can point to that says, okay, we're not there yet, obviously. I mean, the number that you want is zero fatalities. But is there a city that you say, look at what they're doing, look at how drastically different or better their numbers are because they've done X, Y, and Z? Is there anything out there right now that you would point to?
Oh, sure. Lots of cities are doing really great work on this. Boston is excellent. Seattle, San Francisco. I think a particular note is New York City, and I know everyone wants to think of themselves as not in the same class as New York City, and that's a very different world, but their Vision Zero policy and implementation plan is really great. It's comprehensive. It covers street design. It covers enforcement. It covers data collection, and the recent budget from the mayor's office supports investing in bringing that fatality number down to zero.
Eric, what is the Rochester Complete Streets policy that you referenced? Give us a broad outline of what that is and how that has played into safety here.
Okay, well, it was adopted in November of 2011. And what it does is it mandates that that the city take the interests of all users into account when we plan, design, build, and maintain our city streets. So that's bicyclists, pedestrians, the disabled community, transit riders, as well as drivers.
And so you talk about taking everyone into account. And let me ask David Vega Barakowicz, who's, again, the director of the Designing Cities Initiative at NACTO, this notion of taking everybody into account. Once in a while, David, you hear someone say, well, you know, we're never going to be Europe. You're never going to see mass transit quite on those scales, that we are a car-driven society. That's what we have. But when you hear Eric talking about it, it does seem to be that the needle is moving a little bit. You know, I know there's no one-size-fits-all, but is the needle moving towards more mixed-use transportation?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, the national trends are definitely pointing in that direction as far as, you know, people are getting their driver's license later. The sort of symbol of, you know, American car culture is frankly on the wane. At the same time, we're seeing a significant part of the population kind of move back to cities and sort of reactivating cities. And a big part of what's changed over the last several years is that there's really been some concerted efforts around the country to kind of change the standards and sort of the design criteria that we that kind of govern our streets from being really auto-centric and really about sort of accommodating motor vehicles toward taking into account pedestrians, cyclists, transit users. So it sort of changed the DNA of our streets in a way.
And David, I'll ask you a kind of the same kind of question I asked Stephanie. Point to an American city that is really much more mixed use than we're used to with our car-centric cities.
Well, I think that Stephanie brought up some great examples, and you know, definitely New York stands out, albeit you know, one with definitely a different built environment. You know, the city of Portland Portland, Oregon, has really historically been a leader, not only in sort of changing their transportation habits, but also looking comprehensively at the relationship between transportation and land use, and trying to encourage the development of, you know, we would call kind of transit-oriented communities where they're designed and sort of built so that people there don't really need to necessarily own a car or aren't using a car for their primary mode of transportation. Again, Seattle, San Francisco, New York, Chicago has been really doing a great job of this as well. And certainly some smaller cities are leaders in this. Boulder, Colorado is a great example. Denver, Colorado, again, is another one.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, and I was going to ask Eric that same question, because the cities we're hearing mentioned, Eric, are some of the largest cities in the country, and Rochester is certainly a mid-sized city, but not, you know, not to the levels of the Seattles and the San Franciscos and the New York cities, et cetera. And so is it easier for the larger municipalities to be more mixed use with transportation, and realistically, what do you see, where do you see Rochester going in that direction?
Well, perhaps it's easier, but you know, we do need to keep up, and we do need to compete with them for attracting and retaining residents and jobs and investment. I give a lot of credit to those cities that David's mentioned, and those that make up the NACTO list of cities. You know, they have the ability; they've taken a leadership role in trying out new things and innovating, and allows cities such as Rochester to learn from them and hopefully do one better in the future. And, you know, so we're doing that, and things like the Urban Street Design Guide that NACTO's recently put out are helping us push the needle here in Rochester. So we're moving in that direction, even in Rochester and cities our size, with things like, as you've seen on the streets, with the bike lanes and the changes to our traffic patterns or major projects like the Inner Loop project. We are moving towards a more balanced transportation system.
We're talking to Eric Frisch in studio, who is a transportation specialist with the City of Rochester. Stephanie Seskin's on the phone from the National Complete Streets Coalition. David Vega Barakowicz is the director of the Designing Cities Initiative at NACTO, all talking about the future of American cities, the way we travel, the way we interact with pedestrians. And here is a comment from one of our listeners. John from Rochester says he thinks the streets are safer with bike riders. Car drivers are being more careful. So at least John is saying that there's some progress there. Let me start local, and then we'll take it national on that point, because I think there's a lot to talk about when it comes to bicyclists. Do you agree with John, Eric, that at least in Rochester, it's safer now than it was a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago for bicyclists?
I'd say so. With every new bike lane and bike marking we put out there, I think we're making things safer. We're making it more feasible for people to choose bicycling for their regular daily trips. And as there's more and more people bicycling, there's more and more opportunity for drivers to get used to bicyclists being in the roadway. And I've seen it on my bike rides. People are just, I think, a little more understanding. And, you know, it goes both ways. People need to understand how to use our facilities. Drivers need to understand how to share the road, and cyclists need to know how to use our facilities. But I definitely think we're getting there.
How is it going? I'll start with David. Nationally, when it comes to the relationship between motorists and bicyclists, what do you see happening nationally?
Well, what I would say is, you know, we're seeing a shift from the kind of inner city cyclist, this kind of aggressive messenger biker, kind of a road warrior, toward the kind of cyclist that's sort of standing upright, not necessarily going that fast. We're definitely seeing a much broader demographic cycling. We've been really encouraged by some of the trends in particular around bike share systems like CityBike in New York City that are bringing a whole new kind of rider to our streets. And I think that it's changed the dynamic nationally. Not only are we seeing with an increase in infrastructure and the advent of bike share programs more cyclists, but we're seeing more drivers who kind of understand what it's like to be a cyclist on the street and therefore sort of changing the dynamics of how we drive and bike in cities.
Stephanie, I'd like you to weigh in on your perspective on the safety and the relative safety of bicyclists and how that might factor into to some of the work that your group has done.
Sure. Well, there's a proven concept out there called safety in numbers, and it's where you have more people who are biking and more people who are walking. Those people are, in fact, safer, and it does have to do with perceptions, realizing that there are other people out there than those who are driving cars. A lot of tennis facilities come along with that. And by doing things like bike lanes, especially protected bike lanes, you are creating environments where people understand that they need to go slower, they need to expect other users of the road to be around, and those go a long way to helping pedestrian safety, too.
Eric, you were hinting at your own experience. Do you bicycle around Rochester?
I wouldn't call myself one of the road warriors that David mentioned. I'm certainly not the type A cyclist. You know, through my job, I've gotten pretty comfortable with bicycling, so I do it more often than I used to. That's for sure. And I'll be honest, it's pretty comfortable.
Was his characterization fair of you know, obviously things are changing, but that road warrior, I think we've probably seen them, right? Is that fair?
Sure, sure. Yeah, and you know, for them, the infrastructure that we're putting out doesn't necessarily matter too much. You know, they're going to choose to ride regardless. But, you know, there's a lot larger market for people who might want to replace a car trip with a bike trip. And for them, for me, having dedicated space and maybe even protected space will make all the difference in whether I choose to bike or not.
I want to read a short rant that went viral and about 3 years ago. Felix Salmon, who is a financial journalist who works for Reuters, among others, was talking about the relationship among pedestrians, bikes, and cars. He called it the delicate dance in New York City streets. Now, again, we're talking about New York City, different than Rochester. But I think, again, there are lessons to learn here. Now, he wrote this rant, and it went viral. And I don't know if all bicyclists I know would agree with it, but I'd like to get our panel's thoughts. Here's what he wrote. Quote, bikes can and should behave much more like cars than pedestrians. They should ride on the road, not the sidewalk. They should stop at lights, and pedestrians should be able to trust them to do so. They should use lights at night. And, of course, they should ride in the right direction on one-way streets. None of this is a question of being polite. It's the law. But in stark contrast to motorists, nearly all of whom follow nearly all the rules, most cyclists seem to treat the rules of the road as strictly optional. They're still in the human-powered mindset of pedestrians who feel pretty much completely unconstrained by rules. And the result is decidedly suboptimal for all concerned, but mostly for the bicyclists themselves. New York needs to make a collective quantum leap from treating bicyclists like pedestrians to treating bicyclists like motorists. And until it does, bike relations will continue to be marked by hostility and mistrust. I'll start right here in the room. Eric Frisch, what do you think?
There might be some truth to what he's saying with respect to, you know, bicyclists should follow the rules of the road. But I would certainly take exception to the notion that most drivers obey the laws. I don't know many drivers who obey the speed limits and come to complete stops at stop signs and, you know, make safe turns and all those things. And often, you know, when drivers don't follow those rules of the road, it makes things a lot less safe when they don't than if a bicyclist doesn't.
What about his point, Eric, that bicyclists are prone to behaving more like pedestrians than motorists?
I think that's changing, too. You know, when it's kind of the Wild West and there aren't infrastructure out there that's guiding bicyclists for how to ride, then, you know, what do you expect to some extent? You know, I think that as we develop a quality bike network, you're going to see more and more people understanding the rules of the road, and they're going to follow it. I know I'm seeing it. Then again, you know, maybe some of the laws need to be modified a bit for bicyclists too. For instance, stop signs. You know, maybe bicyclists should be allowed to treat a stop sign as a yield. You know, it's a lot. It's not as unsafe for a bicyclist to yield at a stop sign versus a driver.
Stephanie, what do you think regarding the notion that when bicyclists behave more like pedestrians than motorists, they are putting themselves at risk more?
I'm not sure. I think that bicycling is has been overlooked a lot in street design and law, and you sort of have to operate in this weird middle space where you're being told that you need to operate like a car, and yet you're not surrounded by 2,000 pounds of steel and plastic protecting you. And so certainly in the places where bicyclists are riding on sidewalks or other places where they're not necessarily expected and might not be the best for people who are walking, the fact is in those places, it's probably because those bicyclists don't feel comfortable on the street and aren't comfortable operating like a person who's driving a car.
David, can you weigh in as well on that rant that went viral about it? I thought that rant was a little over the top because I'm not comfortable with this dichotomy that either bicyclists are great or they are a nuisance and they are causing trouble in all traffic. I view it as drivers and bicyclists are the same, that most of them behave, some do not, and that coexisting is good for everybody. But he's saying they've got to behave like drivers. What do you think?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, if you look at countries where 20 or 30% of the population bikes every day, what you'll find is that cyclists and cycling infrastructure in particular really does sort of occupy a kind of intermediate realm between drivers and pedestrians. And that's actually a very kind of necessary kind of way of treating cyclists because, as Stephanie said, you're not necessarily able to attain the speed that drivers do. You're not necessarily feeling as protected as they do. And oftentimes when we go out and talk with people about building infrastructure for bikes, we tell them, you know, if somebody's cycling on the sidewalk, you know, that may be illegal, but it's also an indication to an engineer or a designer that person doesn't feel safe riding in the road. So obviously, New York City is a special case just because the pedestrian volumes are so, so high that a cyclist riding on the sidewalk is really a pretty significant disruption. But in many places, bikes riding on the sidewalk, especially for younger children, is actually quite common and in some cases even legal. So I think we're, you know, nationally kind of beginning to see that, you know, cyclists aren't drivers. And they do require a different treatment. And some of the laws that we define, you know, in the 1920s or 30s or even earlier, many of which are really kind of based on vehicles and bicyclists designed as vehicles, need to be sort of reevaluated in slightly more human terms that can help us achieve cities that are safe for people to ride.
Before we get to our short break here, I want to get a couple more quick questions and points in. Michelle writes to us on Twitter, in Rochester, people seem to jaywalk more than anywhere else I've ever lived. Does that contribute to pedestrian deaths? I'll start right here in the room. A lot of jaywalking around here, or is that just a small sample size for a newcomer, Eric?
Yeah, I'd say that's a pretty common condition in most cities, and I think it kind of gets back to what David's saying, that they're responding to how they feel safe crossing the street, and does the infrastructure provide for the movements they're trying to make.
And before I let Stephanie go, because we're going to finish our discussion with David and Eric when it comes to the future of urban design, before I let Stephanie go, I just want to kind of wrap up on the notion of looking at the 10 years of pedestrian injuries and fatalities, and what are some closing thoughts? What do you want to leave with us and our audience about what you want people to learn, not just from these numbers, but when it comes to behavior, Stephanie?
Sure. Well, the numbers are staggering and chilling, and the thing is we know how to prevent almost all of these deaths and injuries, and it's through better road design and in making sure that our transportation investments are promoting a multimodal approach that accommodates the needs of people who are walking and biking, and in many cases does more than just accommodate, but goes beyond to make it comfortable and safe and inviting for everyone. So I would urge not just to be shocked by these numbers, but to go to your public meetings, to talk with your city council members about making sure that your streets are safe and pleasant.
Stephanie Seskin, thanks for taking the time to join us on Innovation Friday today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And a very short break here. Come right back, and David, Eric, and you talking about the future of urban design, what we've learned not only from what Stephanie's talking about, but what we can expect our cities to look like as we approach transportation in the future. That's next on Connections on member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections here on this Friday afternoon. And if you want to weigh in on the future of transportation within your city, your town, and what either what you'd like to see or questions about the future of urban design, you can do that toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Eric Frisch is here. He is a transportation specialist with the City of Rochester. David Vega Barakowicz is on the phone, the director of Designing Cities Initiative at the National Association of City Transportation Officials. Eric, Rochester's got a number of things going on, and we've started to see some change. What is keeping you busiest? What excites you most with your job day to day when it comes to the future of transportation right here in Rochester?
Well, it's an exciting time to be in the transportation planning field. There's a lot of interest in how we get around, and there's two things that came out. If I could just briefly mention that kind of point to where we're headed. I think it's good news for our city is it's been reported that Rochester recently was ranked 15th among large metropolitan areas for an increase in college-educated residents, adding 36,000 roughly over the past 5 years. And also our millennial population has increased 12% over that same time period, which is outpacing the national average. These are good signs for our community's future, and they point to the growing audience for what we're looking to do, because the sort of the millennial population especially is really demanding a new way of living. They're looking for an urban lifestyle. They're looking to reduce the amount of time they spend in a car. And so some of the projects that we're working on, I think the one that gets the most attention and probably deservedly so is our Interloop East Transformation Project, where we're actually in the process of removing an expressway in the downtown area and replacing it with a high-quality city street that's going to be flanked with wide sidewalks, extensive landscaping, and a physically separated two-way cycle track, which is intended to provide a higher level of bicycle accommodation and hopefully and surely attract more bicycle riders in that corridor.
Maxine and others, if you're on the phone waiting, we'll get you in just a second. I do want to make sure we clarify. When we spent an hour on the Interloop project earlier this spring, I was reminded several times to mention that it's a third of the Interloop that's being filled, not the entire Interloop, and that it was based on a lot of study about in terms of traffic flow and the actual use, and then on study on what could actually take the place of it, connecting neighborhoods, more walkability, and all of those things are kind of part and parcel with what you're talking about, isn't it, Eric?
Yeah, I think it's emblematic of what what's happening nationally and what we're trying to bring about locally. You're right. It's just one section of the inner loop. Who knows what the future will bring? But yeah, reconnecting neighborhoods, making it better for walking and biking is critical for the health of our downtown area.
Would you be surprised in 5-10 years if more of the inner loop, not just the one third that's being done now, would you be surprised if more of it or all of it is not filled?
I don't know about all of it, but certainly I would not be surprised if we were able to remove some more of it, reconnect University Avenue, and maybe make East Main Street a little more of a hospitable environment for non-motorized users.
Maxine, thanks for calling Connections on Innovation Friday. Go ahead.
Hi. We talked earlier about jaywalking, and I just wanted to talk about some of my experiences as a pedestrian in Rochester that encouraged me to jaywalk. One is that when I cross the street, quite often the cars have a green light, but I don't, as a pedestrian, I'm seeing the little man, the little walking man, he's red.
I've been there.
And so that encourages me, because then I have to wait for that cycle to be through, then I have to wait for the other direction traffic to go, then before I get my chance again, before I can press the little button and get the white man. So I'm greatly encouraged to jaywalk. And what I'm hoping, though, in the future, I'm hoping that Rochester will have streets so that when the cars have green, I have the little white walking man, and I'm not encouraged to jaywalk.
Thanks, Maxine.
In addition.
Hold on, Maxine.
Okay.
We'll get to your next thought. Let Eric jump in on that one. Go ahead.
I think it's a great thing to shoot for. In the downtown area is really pretty much the only location where the signals automatically say walk for pedestrians. Otherwise, Maxine's right. You have to push that button, and that can be frustrating.
Go ahead, Maxine. You have another point?
Yes, it's just an addendum to the first one. Then I have a second point. When I push the button, I'd like for that to give me a 3-second lead on the cars. So if I'm there at the beginning before the cycle even begins, I'd like that button to give me 3 seconds before the cars even begin.
All right. Well, you've got a transportation specialist who's been listening.
Okay. I just wanted to talk about my problems as a pedestrian in winter. And one is that we have sidewalk snow plowing, which is wonderful, but when they plow, they leave a mountain of snow and ice between my sidewalk passage and crosswalks. So I can't get to the crosswalk. So I try to find the best place I can to cross, but it's often not with the crosswalks because that has been plowed up by the sidewalk plow. So I'd like the sidewalk plow to go into that crosswalk area between where the pedestrian walks and the street and make a little curve there and make that crosswalk accessible to me.
Thank you, Maxine. What do you think, Eric?
I think it's a great goal, and if there's any inventors out there, if we can come up with a solar-powered heated curb ramps, that would be easy to do for us. I'd love to see that because that would take the operator out of the equation.
And you're not being totally flippant there, are you?
I think we would love to see it.
You'd never.
It would solve some problems.
Lisa, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. Good morning. Hi.
Good
Eric.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Yes, indeed.
Hi, Eric. People in my neighborhood have been working with you very successfully for the last few years, addressing many of these issues, and we thank you for your assistance on them. The comment I wanted to make was how difficult, and this has to do with the jaywalking as well, how difficult it is to try to walk where there's a crosswalk with a light or without a light, because if you try to cross the street, people are treating right on red as pull up as far into the intersection as possible so that you can take your shot at turning right as soon as possible without regard to whether there are people trying to cross the street. And that has created quite an unsafe situation. It's causing me to jaywalk when I never did before.
I encounter it pretty much every day on my walk into work at one particular intersection, and I'm sure pretty much any city employee would share my sentiment on that drivers, as they approach certain intersections especially, if they're looking to make a right turn, they'll look left, and then they'll go, and they won't look for the pedestrian who's coming the other way. And I agree that does encourage pedestrians to often make some difficult choices rather than using a signalized crosswalk. So definitely enforcement is needed, difficult to come by, but needed. I know that the police department is stepping up enforcement at these sort of uncontrolled mid-block locations where we have crosswalks to encourage compliance with the state law for yielding to pedestrians, and I hope we can grow that as we move ahead.
Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate the call. 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Eric Frisch is here, a transportation specialist with the City of Rochester. David Vega Barakowicz is on the phone with us, the director of the Designing Cities Initiative at NACTO. And I want Eric to make a point. We'll kick it over to David here. Before the hour started, Eric, you were saying that this guide that NACTO, and our listeners can't see it, I'm looking at the Urban Street Design Guide, is sort of an interesting and important new step because some of the old policy on urban design or the way that we created design policy was a little more top-down or more of a blanket approach. What do you like about what you're seeing?
That's right. You know, most of the previous design guidance has either been issued by the federal government or state DOTs, and sort of a one-size-fits-all approach to designing streets in this country. And it wasn't until the NACTO guides came out, started to recognize that cities are unique animals and they require different ways of thinking. And this Urban Street Design Guide, as well as the Urban Bikeway Design Guide, are helping us and cities all over the country design our streets to meet the needs of cities today. You know, we spent the better part of 50 years kind of tearing apart cities to make them serve the car. And with few exceptions, you know, it worked. You know, cities did start serving the car pretty well, but they tore apart a lot of what made cities attractive and great places to be. And so it's really time for that new paradigm, and it's really timely that NACTO has come out with this guide.
David, give us a sense, based on what you just heard from Eric, give us a sense for what modern urban design is starting to look like. And I ask that because I have a very interesting question from John online. John wants to know that essentially he said, we have been destroying cities as we adapt to new forms of transportation for years. If you were starting from scratch, what would a big American city look like? That's an interesting question.
Well, you know, I think, and I do appreciate the callers who called in, just because I think that some of their sentiments actually speak to a lot of the things that the guide really attempted to sort of change about how we design streets and public spaces. And that's that kind of good design really breeds good behavior. And, you know, the prevailing design standards that Eric mentioned, there are some things in there that would really, I think, surprise the public. For instance, you know, every street in the prevailing design guidelines at the state and federal level is actually referred to as a highway. You know, when they refer to crosswalks, oftentimes they'll refer to crosswalks that don't have any marking at all, but that's still thought of as a crosswalk. These are things that the public and ordinary citizens just don't really realize are actually governing sort of how their environment operates. As to the question of sort of ideal urban design or sort of ideal urban form, it's kind of a bit ironic to sort of talk about the future of cities because I think in many ways we're trying to introduce so many different elements of the sort of city that we lost and the city that we're sort of nostalgic for. You know, we're seeing a movement back towards streetcars and toward buses that really move high volumes of people, and a pedestrian city where, you know, you can walk to a corner store and buy a, you know, a carton of milk as opposed to having to drive 20 minutes to a strip mall to do that. But at the same time, you know, if we look at trends today, technology is really significantly changing how we move around. You know, in New York City, where we're based, they just introduced real-time bus information, which basically enables people to, in some ways, be smarter about how they use the transportation system and be able to sort of plan accordingly. At the same time, we're seeing other trends that are sort of longer that are going to be significant in shaping our cities, autonomous vehicles and self-driving cars will introduce new parameters into how we think about driving and think about mobility and sort of the advent of shared mobility and shared cars is definitely going to introduce some new parameters to how we think about transportation. But in all that, I think the biggest message to get across and the biggest new movement is sort of looking at some of the older forms of transportation, walking and biking, and using those as tools to create a more compact city where we kind of come together and really have a high quality of life. And that's what the transportation movement or the public space movement is really about in the United States today.
Let's grab one more quick call. Stephen from the city of Rochester. Go ahead, Stephen.
Yes, I do an extensive amount of walking, a lot of times just for health reasons, too, to get some exercise in that. And I have found over the years that it is a lot safer to walk in between intersections than to cross at intersections, because you're doubling the chances of some probable accident occurring, because you got traffic coming at you four ways, as opposed to in the middle of the street, you only got two ways to look instead of four. And I believe that possibly if they did some striping in the middle of intersections between for people to walk safely across there, you could probably reduce the amount of accidents you're having and fatalities with pedestrians.
Thanks for the call, Stephen. What do you think?
We do have mid-block sort of uncontrolled crosswalks that are marked, and there are more and more being added. Other things that can be done, and we're doing that at Midtown and on the Inner Loop project, are adding pedestrian refuge islands where you provide a space in the middle of the street for a pedestrian to wait. There's one right out here on State Street, which again helps people get to the middle of the street and then to the other side, reduce the amount of time that they're in mixed traffic. So I certainly understand the point.
We have a comment online from Sarah, and I want to kick this over to David. Sarah says, is design trying to influence behavior? Are they trying to convince us to drive less?
Well, I would kind of turn that on its head and say that our existing designs have actually, for the past 50 or 60 years, really sort of taken biking, walking, and even to a certain degree, transit usage out of the equation. Sort of discouraging all three of those modes through design. So design, how we sort of shape our streets, whether that be through the lens of a pedestrian or through the lens of a vehicle, has a tremendous implication on whether or not we're going to choose to use one mode of transportation or another. And, you know, one of the things that we've been trying to really do is sort of draw a tangible link between our city policies. So that may be, you know, we want 20% of our city to be able to walk to work, or 20% of our city to take the bus to where they need to go. We want to draw a link between the policy and the design, because, you know, Stephanie mentioned the complete streets policy. Complete streets policies are great as a sort of umbrella policy that you can establish about how you treat everybody using the road. But if you don't actually dig into the design details, but say, you know, this person no longer has to wait 2 minutes at an intersection before they cross the road. You know, if you don't do that, you really can't influence behavior at all. And I think that a lot of the guidance that we've developed is trying to shape how it is that our city leaders have sort of put forth their goals for transportation in our major metropolitan areas.
I have just about 2 minutes left here. At the end of the year, we like to revisit our conversations with some of the best thinkers in different fields and ask them to look ahead and have a little fun and get a little whimsical and look at the future and say, I expect X. You know, look, nobody can see the future perfectly, but I'll start in the room here. Eric, 10, 20, 25 years from now, what's the biggest difference on the change on the scene in Rochester when it comes to the way we get around and the way the city looks to us?
I hope... that we're going to have a balanced transportation system where people have choices, quality choices, that they don't have to feel that they are wed to their automobile, but they can walk, they can bike, they can use the bus, or who knows what other transit options might be available at that time. And it's, you know, it's going to, we're going to be a much more vibrant, healthy city moving forward.
Will fewer people drive in Rochester?
That would be the goal, to get a greater share of trips being made by non-cars, because cars and cities aren't always a good mix.
And wrapping up with you, David, same kind of question. Looking ahead at the American city in general over the next quarter century or so, what are the biggest changes you see coming?
You know, the biggest change is definitely going to be that you're going to have more people living in cities, and cities are going to be, frankly, more destinations. You know, they're going to be places that people want to go, that people want to live and work and shop, and frankly, places where they can kind of walk to the corner and get everything that they need. And that's something that we've kind of designed out of our system, and something that I think people are going to demand comes back into the fabric of our cities.
And by the way, Eric, when it comes to what we see with the Interloop project and more, that is part of that goal, right? I mean, everything that we see seems to be moving toward that direction. More walkable, more opportunity to be mobile on foot, et cetera, right?
That's right. That's right.
Eric Frisch has been here. He is a transportation specialist with the City of Rochester. David Vega Barakowicz, the director of the Designing Cities Initiative at NACTO. That's the National Association of City Transportation Officials. Has been on the phone with us. David, great stuff, and I really appreciate your insight for the hour. Thanks for taking the time for us.
Thank you.
Eric, thank you very much. And I asked you if you biked in. You walked in. I'm looking outside now. If you're walking again, you're not going to enjoy yourself.
Umbrella.
You did bring an umbrella. It's cold, my friend. You have short sleeves and an umbrella. Thanks for sharing your expertise with us as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
That's Eric Frisch from the City of Rochester. Short break, and coming right back with Hour 2 of Innovation Friday on Connections on this Friday afternoon.